This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. This week, President Bush signed an executive order allowing the creation of military tribunals to try accused terrorists. It was only the latest in a series of measures that has alarmed civil libertarians on both the right and the left. The Justice Department has also expanded a rule allowing the government to monitor conversations between lawyers and their clients. And it has said it has a list of some 5,000 young men it wants to question, a list based mainly on their country of origin and their age. The Bush administration has defended these moves as necessary in times of war. As NPR's Nina Totenberg reports, the history of civil liberties in wartime is not always a pretty one.
Our system of free government is at its most dangerous in wartime. That observation came from the late Justice Robert Jackson. Government power in wartime, he wrote, is usually exercised in haste and excitement when calm legislative consideration is difficult. It is executed in a time of patriotic fervor that makes moderation unpopular. And worst of all, wrote Justice Jackson, it is interpreted by judges under the influence of the same passion and pressures. And so it has been throughout our history, sometimes for good and sometimes not. The first gross invasion of civil liberties occurred when the nation was just coming of age in 1798 and was on the brink of war with France. The rampant fear was of the enemy within. Tens of thousands of French émigrés with their French schools, newspapers, and, it was believed, enemy agents. As the drums of war grew louder, Congress passed and President Adams signed into law the Alien and Sedition Acts, which granted the president the right to expel any foreigner considered dangerous and provided stiff jail terms for anyone who wrote anything about the president, the Congress, or the government that was malicious, false, or scandalous. The law became the instrument of the Adams Party against Thomas Jefferson's, as presidential scholar Stephen Hess observes.
There were members of Congress who went to jail, and of course there were editors of newspapers that went to jail.
At that time in American history, the Supreme Court had not yet established its power of review over acts of Congress, so no test case went to the court, and the law was repealed only after Jefferson became president. The next great challenges to civil liberties came in the Civil War, when President Lincoln suspended the right of habeas corpus. That's the constitutionally guaranteed right for any individual detained or arrested by the government to force those holding him to explain in court the reasons for the detention. Lincoln decided to suspend the writ after anti-Union riots broke out in Baltimore, telegraph lines were cut, and bridges burned to prevent Union troops from arriving in Washington. As historian Alan Brinkley explains, in Maryland and elsewhere in the North, there were large pockets of opposition, and the suspension of the writ was a powerful tool for suppression of dissent.
It made possible the arrest of anyone suspected of disloyalty, and it meant there was no legal pressure to bring them to trial within any normal period of time.
Lincoln also imposed martial law in certain areas of the North where there was strong Confederate sympathy, and he authorized secret military trials to try civilians accused of aiding the South. Again, historian Stephen Hess.
There were tens of thousands of civilians who were arrested by military authorities and several thousand who were tried by military commissions.
Lincoln's view, as he put it in a letter to a friend, was that the Constitution is different in its application in cases of rebellion or invasion involving the public safety from what it is in times of profound peace and public security. The Supreme Court did not agree, eventually ruling some of Lincoln's actions unconstitutional, but not until after the war was over. In World War I, the Sedition and Espionage Acts made it a crime to criticize the president or to express doubts about the war. So wide was the law's reach that leafleteers opposing the draft were imprisoned, as well as the socialist candidate for president, Eugene V. Debs, who got 1 million votes while behind bars. Even the prominent liberal magazine The Nation was confiscated from the mails. Many test cases went to the Supreme Court, but the convictions went undisturbed. Stanford historian David Kennedy notes that as bad as the 1918 measures were, they were a compromise between the executive and Congress.
The Attorney General wanted an act that would suspend the operation of the civil courts altogether in cases of alleged interference with the war effort. He wanted the right to try people in his custody in military tribunals. So it has a certain eerie similarity to the present circumstance.
The invasions of civil liberties during the war persisted immediately afterward in what came to be known as the Palmer Raids. Historians say that era has some parallels to today because the raids followed a series of terrorist bombings. The bombings began in the summer of 1919, and on June 2nd, bombs went off in 8 cities, including Washington, D.C., where Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer's home was partially destroyed. Although it's never been determined who set off the bombs, Palmer blamed domestic communists and anarchists, and he began a series of showy, well-publicized raids, assisted by his aide, J. Edgar Hoover. Palmer's raiders struck without warning and without warrants, smashing union offices and those of communist and socialist organizations, and focusing their attention most of all on aliens rather than citizens. Across the U.S., there were massive arrests. One group of 250, including the radical feminist Emma Goldman, was simply put on a ship to the Soviet Union and deported. But in the end, the raids bore little or no fruit. Historian Alan Brinkley.
The raids produced no evidence whatsoever of any large anarchist plot and no significant numbers of weapons or even literature. So it became actually a huge political embarrassment to A. Mitchell Palmer. It destroyed his presidential hopes and it threatened, although obviously it didn't end, J. Edgar Hoover's career.
Indeed, as historian David Kennedy observes, the excesses that surrounded World War I led to fewer civil liberties violations in World War II.
Roosevelt and the people around him had seen, first of all, how ineffective the suppression of civil liberties was in World War I and how it had backfired politically, and they were pretty self-consciously determined not to follow down that pathway again.
The great and dramatic exception, of course, was the removal from the West Coast and forced internment of 120,000 ethnic Japanese, two-thirds of them U.S. citizens, all of which was portrayed through rose-colored glasses.
A caravan of Japanese-owned trucks and pleasure cars heads inland from the Pacific. Escorted by troopers, they go to make their homes under Uncle Sam's surveillance for the duration. Here in the land of Buffalo Bill, the government is erecting model camp towns, towns in which they'll live unmolested, not as prisoners, but free to work and paid by the United States government. Bathtubs, yes, all the comforts of home. The Japanese in America are finding Uncle Sam a loyal master despite the war.
It's easy to condemn the internment now, and a half century later, the U.S. Congress even issued a formal apology. But as Chief Justice William Rehnquist observed in a book about civil liberties in wartime, at the time of the internment, there was a very real fear of attack on the West Coast by Japanese bombers, if not actual invasion by Japanese ground forces. And the military authorities, worried about sabotage and espionage, made a call that the courts were simply not willing to argue with. After all, the U.S. aircraft industry was concentrated on the West Coast. Ethnic Japanese had access to shipyards, air bases, and oil wells, and could easily observe plane and ship movements. The contrast with today is stark, with the Bush administration almost daily urging Americans not to prejudge their Arab American neighbors based on their ethnicity. And yet, there is the saga of those 1,000-plus detainees, men and women held on charges that have not been disclosed, often with no lawyers provided, and families in the dark as to what's happened to their loved ones. Professor Brinkley believes the Cold War, however, may be the most analogous to our times.
There was a prolonged period of national emergency, or at least national concern about its relationship with the world, which probably parallels our own condition better than any actual war.
The case of Alger Hiss, top State Department officer and confidant of presidents and Supreme Court justices, was pivotal. It may not have represented in itself a denial of civil liberties, but it legitimized the red-baiting of the House Un-American Activities Committee. The denouement came in a face-off with Hiss and his accuser, Whitaker Chambers, a Time magazine editor who testified that he and Hiss had been fellow communists, friends, and conspirators against the U.S. government.
My name is Alger Hiss. I am here at my own request to deny unqualifiedly various statements about me which were made before this committee by one Whitaker Chambers day before yesterday.
According to historian Brinkley, the Hiss hearings transformed a committee held in wide disrepute into perhaps the most important committee in Congress. They also made a young freshman congressman named Richard Nixon, who effectively took over the Hiss prosecution, into a national star. The Hiss hearings were soon followed by the discovery that spies had given the Soviets information to make the atom bomb. Spies in our own midst.
Julius and Ethel Rosenberg have gone to the electric chair. Julius Rosenberg was pronounced dead at 8:00.
The Rosenberg and Hiss cases became an enduring point of controversy, with many on the left to this day insisting that all three were innocent, though recent evidence suggests that the only innocent among them may have been Ethel Rosenberg, who, according to new research, probably knew what her husband was doing but did not participate. The Rosenberg case was an important moment because it ratcheted up fear about domestic communism and led to the power of Senator Joseph McCarthy.
My fellow Americans, there's nothing accidental about this picture. It is a pattern of deliberate communist infiltration. Instead of an admission of guilt or stupidity, cheap politicians from coast to coast join the chorus of the communist daily worker and shout, "Oh, isn't this McCarthyism an awful thing?"
McCarthy's pursuit of alleged communists in government ruined hundreds, if not thousands, of careers. But when he finally took on the army, charging some of its most distinguished members with disloyalty, he had finally gone too far. He was censured by the Senate and died not long thereafter, a broken drunk. At the height of the McCarthy era, Edward R. Murrow put it this way in a famous radio broadcast.
The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves.
The fault can lie with our leaders, too. In wartime, they must make agonizing choices. The courts are loath to second-guess them, as is the public. But as historians note, assaults on civil liberties backfire politically in the long run and breed much more aggressive defenses of civil liberties for the next time round. The ACLU was founded after World War I to prevent such abuses in the future, and the McCarthy era spawned a reawakening of interest in civil liberties. Historian Stephen Hess.
These things, in retrospect, are almost always judged by history to be a mistake. It's not a bad idea to look back at history at this moment and see how little was accomplished other than staining the great reputation of this country.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.